We divided the question into four topics, four subtopics, and what Julie and I will try to do is just give you a view graph for each of the four subtopics and run through the basics and try to express what the status is for the technique for measuring mass and spin and make some comments reflecting what we heard as the needs and directions that should be taken. So the first topic is just the orbital dynamics, or how does the Keplerian motion of stars or gas surrounding the black holes provide mass measurements. And we all know that these mass measurements in Newtonian gravity are an observational cornerstone for black hole science. It's how we've, in the galactic X-ray binaries, have convinced people that black holes really exist. And while that has been a slow progress over the past 10 or 15 years, a very analogous process going on in the extragalactic community has added similar measurements for showing very massive and compact black holes in the centers of other galaxies. So currently there are about 10 good masses from galactic black hole binaries, as we heard from Phil Charles, and we're getting about one every 2 years at the current rate, good to a factor of two. And of course, we want more to do statistics of the mass distributions, period distributions, types of companion stars. But in particular, for the purpose of making mass and spin measurements, the really important things in looking toward the future are to have more cases that overlap the other methods. Some of these methods provide tracks in the MA plane, and if you can constrain with a very good measurement the mass from orbital dynamics of some kind, then you can really have the chance of uniquely describing mass and spin. Now, the other techniques, as we'll talk about in these other subtopics, are nowhere near as reliable. But the best hope is for a convergence where you have a mass measurement and perhaps several tracks in the MA plane, and you start to build up some reliability. And the feedback you get from the mass measurements are really critical to these other methods. An eclipsing system is another thing that would be a very great boost for X-ray binaries, where you can do eclipse mapping, especially with the count rates of XTE. We made an estimate at one time that the 5 sigma detection time scale for XTE for a 3-crab nova maps to something like 2 kilometers for a binary the size of 1655-40. So there's plenty of power here in doing eclipse mapping. It would also provide an accurate sign eye, which I can say a few words later, is a problem for galactic binaries, the biggest fundamental problem, knowledge of sign eye. And then maybe lensing effects, if you're over far enough. That could be extremely interesting if we're lucky enough to get that kind of inclination. The third important point in trying to develop mass measures for galactic binaries is a better understanding of the disk warps and asymmetries in quiescence. Again, Phil Charles talked a lot about this, the ellipsoidal modulations and the velocity profiles of the emission lines in quiescence have some peculiarities, and it undermines our understanding and our knowledge and our ability to make statements about sign I, and that weakens, therefore, the mass measurement inevitably. Now, for the extragalactic black holes, there are 5 of order 5 good masses now and 10 with error bars twice as large. But this is a more rapidly developing field thanks to the measurements of the Hubble Space Telescope. And clearly, we need more of these measurements, and some of the early indications of applying the mass measurements, for instance, what Doug Richstone showed us about the relation or possible correlation between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the bulge. This seems to be sufficiently well-presented and interesting that there should be some thought given as to what this might mean in parallel to testing whether this is real or not. But this is certainly the most straightforward, but yet fundamental part of the effort to measure mass and spin. A second topic is how do you make physical inferences from QPOs and other types of variability? Now, the galactic X-ray binaries are most promising in this regard because of the recent demonstration of 67 to 300 Hertz QPOs in three black hole candidates. In some models, this is a strong signature of mass and spin, but we don't know how to interpret it yet. But the situation is not 100% promising, as the possible explanations include the disco seismic oscillation and lens steering precession, both of which give us tracks in the MA plane. But there's also some work, Demetrios Saltis, and a sort of parallel work by the Amsterdam group, Van der Klis et al., that is looking phenomenologically at pairs of QPOs or QPOs versus breaks in the power spectrum, and is seeing relationships among neutron stars that might branch into the black hole subclass. So as intriguing as this may be, one possible interpretation, in addition to beautiful tracks in the MA plane, which many of us hope dearly becomes reality, it's also a possible extension of neutron star phenomenology, which then it's not clear at all what it would be telling us. But here, there's some concrete evidence to work on, and there's quite a challenge in trying to match theory and prediction with what the observers are seeing and the characteristics of this oscillation. So to make progress, we need to specify emission mechanisms for each model to try to make model predictions then, which would be available as observatories like XTE continue to take data. And then we have to further characterize the observations on the observer side to try to encourage the match with theory. We also want to mention, at least, that there is this ubiquitous red noise in black hole binaries and AGNs, but it primarily appears to be a situation of we have the phenomena and we need the theory. So those are the first two topics, and Julian will continue the report with the final two.
I believe that this will ask the question of both to both reporters.
Afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. Do I actually need the microphone? Okay, thank you. The back row is different from the front row, so that's the sign. The third of these subjects is what you can learn from observations of the continuum spectra. And in principle, one might hope to infer a great many of the interesting parameters of the black hole because the spectrum, of course, depends on them. The problem is that that dependence goes through very complicated channels. And so the problem of inferring the parameters through the spectra is very complex. Now, sort of to zeroth order, what you see is, in fact, a kind of collapse of those complicated spectra and also complicated parameters into a couple of simple observables. It might be phrased as a characteristic temperature and a characteristic size. And in some of the observational work done so far, particularly with the galactic black hole binaries, that's about where matters stand in terms of interpretation of the data. And that characteristic temperature, one might expect, would be related to the accretion rate and the mass in the manner shown, but that's a proportionality. That's not an equal sign with a coefficient. And a good deal of work needs to be done in order to make that a more direct relation. And similarly, also for the characteristic size and the mass. Now, one can do better by actually fitting to the spectra. That's the next job. And the situation at the moment is that for the portion of the sort of quasi-thermal spectra of black holes below the expected peak, the data for AGN are pretty good. The data for the galactic black holes is rather less good. I mean, X-ray spectroscopy is a lot harder than UV, but I think shows signs of rapid improvement. I mean, I would expect that, that certainly ASCA has improved it. XMM should be a great deal better. But the second step in the process is that I think the people calculating these spectra have been realizing gradually that they need to include more and more physics just in the atmosphere solution. And that job is not yet complete. It's become increasingly clear in the last couple of years within the AGN spectral community that, for example, non-LTE effects can be important. Elements heavier than helium can also be important. And people are in the midst of putting this extra physics into their codes. But in fact, the theoretical situation is rather worse than that, because the complications of how the underlying parameters ultimately result in spectra amount, in effect, to tests of disk theory more than connections to the underlying parameters. And these come in several ways. One is that under many circumstances, the character of the predicted spectrum depends in a significant way on the vertical distribution of dissipation in the disk. And that's a complete unknown. I mean, it's an unsolved, open, theoretical problem. There's also, I think, a more fundamental problem, and that is that if you, you know, look at sort of zeroth order picture of what do accreting black holes look like, you see one part of the spectrum that's crudely thermal, and has a temperature crudely what you might predict. And then there's another part that's the hard X-ray power law and is totally unpredicted by classic disk models. And although the luminosity ratio between these two components varies both from object to object and from time to time within given objects, they're always, roughly speaking, comparable. You know, you don't have enormous ratios between the two luminosities. And so clearly, simple disk models are missing a major element. And there must be some structure that puts all that energy into the hard X-ray spectrum, and it must interact in an interesting way with the disk proper. And I think before that relation is better understood, it's going to be very difficult to make clear tests of the disk theory, much less use the disk spectral fits to infer spin and mass and so on. Okay. Now, there's one actually interesting special case presented in the discussion, and that is that microlensing offers an opportunity to actually map out the intensity distribution in the disk and also constrain the basic parameters of the system, the inclination angle, the spin, and possibly the mass, in much the same way that an eclipsing system would work in a binary. You know, in the eclipsing system, you see the progress of an edge moving across the disk. In a microlensing event, you see a caustic moving that's more or less straight on the scale of an AGN disk, sweeping across and amplifying along a line. So it's a very similar kind of story. The problem is that there's, at this point, we only know of one quasar in the sky whose lensing properties are suitable for doing the job.
Okay. Would it be possible to ask to show the movie of this microlensing effect during discussion? We have
okay.
15 minutes afterwards.
Okay, that's in Eric's bag. Okay. Okay. The second topic was how to use the iron K alpha and maybe other emission lines to infer these basic parameters. And again, in principle, you can use them to constrain the intensity distribution of the emission as well as the spin and inclination angle of the disk. There are some problems, though. This is model fitting, after all, so there are issues of uniqueness. At some level, a redshift of a given magnitude is a redshift to the redshift, no matter what the structure of the disk is, or the black hole, that produced it. Some of that ambiguity can be eliminated by careful consideration of other things, like the ionization state. But there, you know, those techniques may not always be available. There can be other ambiguities, as in, is a sharp feature in the profile due to the disk structure, or a contribution from some other part of the system, a companion star or a distant obscuring torus or something of the sort that would produce a narrow cold line. And that may make some problems in actually reliably inferring the spin or the inclination angle. The fact that they're often variable is both a help and a hindrance. Of course, because you have several different shots at different the system when it looks differently, and you can presume that some of the properties ought to be stable and some of them can be allowed to vary. There's an interesting long-term opportunity in the form of reverberation mapping, and this has already been, I think Nick showed one simulation during his talk, and that could yield very interesting results if the instantaneous excitation is by localized flares. And perhaps what we need to do is think about what the statistics of flaring might reasonably be, and also what it would mean to actually do the inverse problem. Given a reverberation experiment, how much can you actually constrain about the system? And finally, there was a very brief discussion that ran into the time limit at the end of the workshop of whether, for example, the optical and UV broad emission lines can be used to constrain the mass. And the first problem to solve here is to convince ourselves that gravity really is the dominant force in controlling the motions. I think this is still quite a controversial question. If that question were settled in favor of gravity, then one could proceed on to asking how you can establish characteristic sizes and speeds from a from an emission region that spans quite a sizable dynamic range in both. And then finally, given the, quote, mass parameter that might produce, how the distribution of orbits would connect you from that mass parameter to an actual mass. Because, of course, the orbital shapes will introduce a coefficient in that relation. But I think that's a sort of third-order step after determining whether they really are dominated by gravity.
About spin. Everybody was speaking about everything except really mass and spin. And next thing is very interesting for me, excuse me, that nobody discussed Dr. Remillard told that we have five black holes and five galactic black holes with good mass estimated, five extragalactic stars with good estimated. But I was really shocked during the talk of Mitch Gagelman, that he told the total amount of black holes in our galaxy, which is 100 million. I never heard so nice numbers like 100 million black holes in our galaxy. Maybe you will answer us now. You remember your beautiful pictures where it was written from 10 to power 6 to 10 to power 8 black holes in the galaxy.
Yes.
What is the origin of 100 million black holes in our galaxy?
Yes. One change the four stars into a black hole.
And this all?
Yeah.
Okay. I think no. I think that there is a very strong observational evidence against. And this evidence is the following, that if we have really 100 million black holes in our galaxy, many of them would cross molecular clouds, giant molecular clouds. And I may estimate myself, and the upper limit is somewhere around 1 million, that we have one black hole inside molecular cloud, which would accrete. And it would be very specific accretion. You would have falling of the gas at practically Eddington limit, then
due to the heating of the gas around expulsion, and then again, like Rayleigh bubble, you have focusing again, and this would be such thing, play a variable source. And no one source in any molecular cloud of the galaxy, and this gives very good upper limit, and 10^8 black holes in the galaxy is much more. This is my opinion. But let us check together.
Yeah. I mean, of course, that's assuming that the accretion is radiatively efficient.
Yes. I agree with this, but this is the case. If you are really in the rich giant molecular cloud, then you are in the situation when even advection-dominated models are giving very high efficiency.
And of course, another interesting question is if you have isolated black holes, they might have, on average, fairly high spatial velocity.
Yes. If you take that all of them are in the plane of the galaxy, restrictions are much more strong. And we have also lower limit, and this lower limit is connected just with the amount of transients, and we made this estimate, many people did afterwards. This is between 3,000 and 10,000 black holes in the galaxy. Therefore, we have lower limits, but upperly, let us consider your numbers as upper limit, okay? Where you are in between. Okay, please, yes?
Comment on that. The formation of massive black holes and massive stars is not a solved problem for me. What is the mass cut which stars class of black holes? In addition, there's constraints to the chemical evolution of galaxies, where basically there's a very different yield of what rises along the mass. And Joe Silk and others have postulated that a fair fraction of the dark matter is trying to look at the galaxies between those stars and massive black holes.
Nobody's against neutrons. This is the only question. Okay, I think if it is possible to show really what was very impressive during that session, this was the movie, how microlensing is working in this QSOs. Is it possible to show or not? Or no?
I have it right here.
Yes, if you could here, prepare right. Or now, or we can show this in there. But this is new method, and it is interesting to see. I think the majority of people haven't seen this. And this beautiful method, and also what is important, I am just helping to person who would show us, to author of the paper. This is the first situation when we see the variability, spectral variability of black hole due to microlensing. Usually when you are thinking for object, it is impossible to change the spectrum. Here we would see that really we have the very strong variability of the spectrum.
Is it theory or
it's theory, but I think it is very, please look, it's very close to reality because we are observing these sources already. And now, please. Yes.
Okay, I didn't know I was going to do this. This is a model for an accretion disk around a black hole. In the upper right hand corner you see that this is a highly inclined accretion disk, so you see it. This is a logarithmic scale, so there's a bright hot spot here, and you can see the relativistic effects bending light from the back of the disk. And you see that as the star passes in front of the accretion disk, there's a time when the caustic will cross the disk, which is shown by the line going across. In the left-hand corner, upper left, we have what you could see if we had an optical VLBA experiment. So this is about a microarcsecond in scale, and you can see two images of the accretion disk that occur outside the caustic region, and then as the caustic crosses, it produces two other bright images, which create a strong amplification in the light curve. The lower left shows the bolometric luminosity versus time, and you can see where the caustic crosses the disk. Their amplification is quite high when the caustic passes the hot spot. And as the caustic first amplifies the outer part of the accretion disk, the spectrum becomes somewhat redder, and then as it goes to the inner part, the spectrum becomes very hard when it amplifies the regions which are much higher temperature.
And it's very interesting because this is, it's difficult to, when was the beginning of the talk, I thought, oh, it must be, everything is very simple. But really, you are imaging different parts of the disk, and you have the very peculiar variability with time. And this is, it would be very interesting to detect such things, and we will get a lot of information. Yes, other questions, please. Ramesh, please.
Yeah, Julian mentioned that the presence of the corona makes the modeling of the disk a problem, and it's of course true. But I believe there are at least some X-ray binaries in the so-called high state where the corona is really very weak. It's there, of course, there is a power law tail, but the luminosity in that power law tail is really only a few percent, or at most 10% in some of these cases. I think those are the systems that one should really concentrate on. That's, if at all the disk theory is going to work, that's where it's going to work. And I believe if we just concentrate on those systems, we might be able to at least eliminate the complication of the corona.
Yeah, this like Novamus and
Super High State. Exactly. Yes. DS2000, there are some
yes,
of
yes, yes.
with very, very soft spectra and
yes, it's. I have a small addition to your question, because this morning we were discussing similar problem with Stephen Colgate, and I asked him, and this, yes, it's a problem. Problem is the following: are we able to create magnetic field which has pressure higher than the which has H square divided by T is higher than the pressure inside the disk? According to Stephen Colgate, it's possible, like Schwarzman. I know from many classical physicists in Russia that they are thinking that the pressure of magnetic field is much smaller and then corona is weak. But it is very interesting to see the numerical computations of Brandenburg, of Hawley, where you see how the field is growing and then going up. There is a biology of the field. And this is you continuously producing field, and this field is going up. Therefore, in principle, it is possible to create very powerful corona. But this really great question, one is the case of when we have very high luminosity disk, and then there is sharp cut of the no real atmosphere. Then we have very small corona. You were very right. That is interesting. And this is this problem really needs very strong plasma physicists here. Yes, other questions, please.
Yeah, I think I've heard a challenge. Remember, we want to challenge this in the theory community. About 20 years ago in Washington, there was a science meeting put on by NASA going into the planning of the XTE mission. I think some of you probably had that meeting. I was. And the thing I'm struck by is how much more progress there's been on the observational side in that 20 years, the theoretical side, in the issue of time dependence on accretion disks and accretion flows. In the 20 years on the theory side, we've had some good understanding of individual subjects, like this was talking about psychological oscillations, for example, but we're still lacking any kind of integrative idea of how this depends on time. That's, of course, a very complicated business, but sometimes it's easier to understand the workings of something when it breaks than when it's time dependent. So I think we need to work harder on that.
Thank you. Yes, if there is a short break, I will tell that it was very interesting what Dr. Remillard told us, that there is discovery of three very high-frequency cupolas from black hole candidates, and the last one is 300 Hz. We are really coming to very close to kilohertz cupolas, which are observed in the neutron stars. And I was very happy to hear that Psaltis is constructing some model. Maybe he will tell us a few words about this, how to connect these cupolas which we are observing at low frequency noise in the neutron stars, where this is just this continuous production of new cupolas in the neutron stars. And now black holes are giving the same. At the same time, everybody here who was working in the 70s, we all thought that immediately when X-ray detectors would be of the dimension of RXTE, it would be discovered millisecond or 100 microseconds flares from CX-1. There are no such flares. And it's very interesting to hear from the people who are here, I know from Rothschild, for example, the people try to observe it, and there is nothing. This really very interesting, because in the supermassive black holes, we really see a very strong variability on the day or month scale, which are corresponding to these milliseconds. Therefore, there is some additional physics. But it's very interesting to, maybe Psaltis will tell us a few words, what is the relation. And before you are beginning, I remember that everybody considered that Kupelo is the signature, just influenced by Alpar-Shaham model, that is signature of neutron star. And then with Ginga, with Granat results, we discovered Kupelos in black holes, and now we understand that bulk of the low frequency Kupelos in neutron stars are also due to disk. Please, Dimitris, if you would tell us your words.
I wish I had one, but I'm absolutely there's no physics in it. And so far, the only thing that we managed to do is trying to compare to the Kupelos in neutron star black hole system, and we found clear correlations that are extremely weird, nobody can buy. The soul is progressing, but it's from you to have QPOs with two frequencies to black or QPOs with S frequencies. So we think that this thing is the same phenomenon.
But where you are speaking about 1 Hz in black holes, but there are 300 Hz in black holes.
There are three types of QPOs in this system, there are two or three types of QPOs in black holes, but range from Hz to hundreds of Hz for black holes or for tens of Hz specific distances, and we think that these are the same phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And what is the information we could get, as Ranular mentioned, what information is possible to get from low frequency noise? Is low frequency noise the same in neutron stars and black holes today?
As far as one can say, by looking plainly at the velocity of the data and the correlations and the energy
and
the
theology
of the
frequency
of the
neutron
stars. So there's
no
difference between them.
Yes, please.
In way of sort of a rebuttal, I would just point to figure Jean showed in her talk, how in particular the 67 Hz QPO in 19+10 looked to be so stable with such large changes in luminosity. And I think that that's the cornerstone of our hope as we continue to analyze the data, that it is more of a fundamental clock of some kind showing you something about the central object. Because obviously the conditions would have changed so much. And we have at least 23 days now where we've seen 67 Hz and 67 plus or minus 2 Hz. So,
this,
to some people, that's an impressive result that
it's
still.
Who only has predicted this theory? I tell you, this is important.
I just want to add something to that. This is also the same thing. I think that in 1930, with the frequency of the frequency is also constant, not both the luminosity, the effect of luminosity increases by factors of 2 or 3. And again, the idea that this is linked to the same blood, so maybe this is the same thing.
Okay, thank you, Roger.
Just make the point that neutron cells are great. Going back to the original business of measuring the mass and the spin, neutron cells are very important because they don't have much spin in a relativistic sense. And they provide a means of calibrating it. Those oscillations that come from the disk, they provide a means of calibrating this method if you then want to use it for black holes, because you do know what the masses are in those cases. You haven't got the ambiguity of the spin, which will remain for a while in the case of the black hole candidate.
But I think that in reality, with 300 Hz or 400 Hz rotating neutron star, we are in reality, this already matrix, which is, it is really strong gravity, and there are, it is equivalent to the Kerr, for example, black hole with 0.28 or 0.2 or something. And this, it is small, there are no extreme effects, but if you have counter rotation, I already told this, it is possible with, if, for example, you have charge exchange like reaction in the global cluster, another star is coming and you have counter rotating neutron star, disk and counter rotation. It is possible to extract due to accretion up to 61% of M dot C sphere due to accretion. It's much more than critical care. Just if you take normal general relativity, compute this, and this is the efficiency of disk rotation of the counter-rotating neutron star, and you are taking energy from the rotation of neutron star. Yeah. If it's necessary, I have picture with me this computation. It's much more than black hole. Therefore, neutron star can produce a lot of very interesting things.
Always more efficient.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is. Jean-Pierre is telling neutron star is always more efficient. Okay. It's interesting. Yes, please.
I have a challenge to observers instead. Okay.
Okay.
I'd really like to see the next generation of after XDE really be able to go to much higher frequencies, where some of us are predicting harmonics, which could really test the theory.
Yes. And this is it is very important, because there was a strong battle for RFTE. I remember this because I had many discussions with Charlie Pellerin. The best American theoretical people wrote letters and RFTE is not useful. I remember the time. And yes, that there would be no science, and Charlie asked me to write letters that there is some science which is possible to get with XDE. Now, from the report of Gene Swank, we saw that this really crucial thing, that it is very important to have additional square meters, you know, to get great information. And it's very important for community in reality to think about this, because nor AXAF, nor XMM, even nobody permits to use Constellation for these purposes. It is possible to make much, much cheaper spacecraft which would solve these problems with the brighter sources. And we know that to observe brighter sources, it is possible to get a lot of information. Yes, excuse me, other questions to two rapporteurs, but we have then half an hour of joint discussion afterwards, and we will return to these problems. No? Yes, please.
Just one comment.
Yes.
It is assumed that the maximum mass of a compact body not being a black hole is three solar masses in most of the reasoning. In fact, this is not correct, because this is supposed to be the so-called causality limit. But in fact, the reasonable equation of state that gives you maximal mass around six solar masses. I'm not talking here about Q-stars, just normal matter. It depends on the equation of state. It's clear, as Philip has shown, there are two categories. A certain neutron star are never more massive than two solar masses. But we need more information than the mass.
I don't believe in six solar masses myself, but I think it's very important, question. Is it possible to prove that we really are dealing with accretion onto black hole? And one of the possibilities came from McClintock and Ramesh, that really maybe IDF solution is giving us the case where we have a solid surface. But this is very important. It is possible to discuss six solar masses, but really we need additional information. Only just mass is not enough. There is something massive, but I agree that philosophically it is important to think all this. Kevin, please.
Queen Lady's talk was sort of interrupted by the departure of the bus yesterday, but it was pointing out that a reasonable explanation for the output viscosity is the excitation of these co-rotating Rossby vortices. They become a natural source of the modulation of the disk, the QPOs. If so, a measurement of the QPO frequencies as a function of the wavelength towards softer, that is, towards lower temperature, means a larger radius, always in the low state of the disk, would be a general confirmation or refutation of the notion that this modulation is associated with the basic instability of the disk.
Thank you, and I believe that Stephen Colgate is mentioning that during what was even impossible to speak 20 or 30 years ago, that now we have the one type of instabilities in the accretion disk. This is Velikov, Chandrasekhar, Balbus-Howley instability, which really is able to permit the existence of the disks. And before, we are speaking that disks are existing because they are existing. And but it is obvious that physics is so rich that there must be other mechanisms. And it is very important to consider all possible mechanisms, and even without seed magnetic field. And as I understand, Stephen Colgate and his students are able now to produce not turbulent and not magnetic field viscosity connected with just with existing core of Wurms and Rossby type instability.
The discussion group.
Mm-hmm. There was. Oh, we will return to this subject. Okay. Next.
Okay, where are my glasses?
We are becoming younger and younger. how does the mass inflow and outflow vary with the mass supply rate?
Okay.